Earlier, we were talking about ways we could tinker with the atmosphere to fix the climate. But how about just not polluting, cutting way, way back on those dangerous greenhouse gases? Gus Speth is the founder of the World Resources Institute and co-founder of the Natural Resources Defense Council, and he knows that in the world of realpolitik, that is a tough sell. He told Steve Paulson the problem is we have a really hard time imagining an economy without growth.
We have this growth fetish, which I think is a very important feature of our political and social and economic landscape.
When you say growth fetish, economic growth?
Yes, GDP growth mm-hmm. in particular.
I think a lot of people would say that is the mark of a thriving economy.
Most people would say that, but look at the facts. Since 1980, GDP has grown by over 125%. The economy has more than doubled in size. And during that time, poverty mounted, inequality mounted, 42,000 manufacturing plants closed their doors, wages flatlined, life satisfaction flatlined, trust went down, depression went up, and environment declined. I mean, this is what happened in the context of really high rates of over time of economic growth in our country. Even today, we have economic activity measured by GDP, which is simply the sum of all the economic transactions, good, bad, and indifferent in the society. GDP today is larger than it was before the 2008 recession, but we still have maybe 15% of the workforce unable to find full-time jobs.
Well, you talk about a post-growth economy. What does that mean?
Well, it means a place where the overwhelming priority is not to grow GDP. It may grow 1 year. It may not grow 1 year. That's not important. What's important is whether you're growing the things that the society really wants to grow. So we have to ask, what's the economy for? And if we had a good measure of sustainable economic welfare, monetized, like GDP is a monetized measure, that would be great. We could look at it and try to grow it. But GDP is not something you particularly want to grow just for the sake of seeing it growing. My friend Herman Daly has a great phrase, uneconomic growth. You know, basically, over time, the benefits of additional growth decline, the costs go up, and pretty soon the costs of extra growth are more than the benefits that you reap from it.
So are you saying that it's entirely possible that we could have a thriving country even if our GDP was declining year after year?
Well, I certainly believe that we could have a prosperous, happy, well-to-do society, far more equal and pleasant than the one we have today, with poverty almost all eliminated, if we pursued the right policies, yes. But you know what it requires? It requires a real government, a government that's sufficiently capable and competent, a government that is rigorously democratic and in which we trust and are willing to, you know, work with government at different levels to achieve social and environmental ends.
So government to some degree is the answer. I mean, of course, that's been a huge issue in our political debates over the decades. It's ratcheted up. And, you know, a lot of people would say, you know, you can't get past the sort of bureaucratic nature of government. You're saying that's not true.
No, I don't think it's true. We see government all the time doing, important things. You know, you just look at some of the great things that government have done. The whole civil rights movement and the laws that undergirded that. The initial phases of the environmental movement. I think a lot of steam has gone out, but in the 70s when Ed Muskie wrote the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act with bipartisan support, it made a huge difference in our country. You have to conclude, I think, that we are in a system which just doesn't prioritize people and place and planet. And I would put right at the top of any list the absolute necessity of dealing with the climate problem, the climate change issue. If we let this climate thing spin out of control, and it's on the verge, I think, of doing that, it will be all-consuming.
You're talking about cutting way back on fossil fuel use, for starters.
For starters. That's the big thing, though. I mean, that is the big target, is a dramatic reduction in our fossil fuel emissions. I mean, basically, we ought to be moving out of the fossil fuel business by mid-century. I mean, that's just what it's going to require. And that means, you know, really serious change in how we run our energy systems and how we use energy.
What do you see as the most promising renewable fuel sources?
Honestly, we tend to neglect the most promising thing, which is dramatic increases in energy efficiency. You know, it's more attractive in many ways to talk about renewable sources. But I think right now the price of solar cells has gone down dramatically, and the payback period is much shorter. And wind is catching on all across the country and in Europe in a big way. These are important developments. But efficiencies, particularly efficiency in the use of fossil fuels. I mean, we ought to have a price on carbon. I mean, it ought to cost those who are putting carbon into the air a lot of money to do it. And when that happens, you know, things will move in the right direction.
You're saying once that happens, then the price of creating renewable energy
will be competitive with fossil fuels. It'll be very attractive economically, and people will conserve and reduce their use of fossil fuels. Efficiencies in all kinds of equipment and homes and automobiles and other things will go up dramatically. You know, this is an old story. We haven't really gotten on the right path yet. Things are better, but we have a long, long way to go to really wring the carbon out of our economy.
You know, it strikes me as I'm listening to you that we can come up with all these kinds of policy recommendations, but ultimately what you're really saying we need is a change in values. I mean, the kind of discussion that we would have in a presidential campaign, for instance, to put some of these kinds of values you're talking about really on the front burner.
Well, I don't think we just sit around and wait on values and culture to change and then expect everything to work out. These things have to move together in parallel. Patrick Daniel Moynihan had a great phrase. You know, he said the central conservative truth is that values really matter and culture really matters and determines the fate of societies. But the central liberal truth is that a society can change its values and its politics can help change its culture and save it from itself. And I think crises, which we will have more of in the future, can be tremendous learning experiences, as the Great Depression was, and if we are prepared for them, so to speak. Transformational leadership is important in value change and cultural change. Telling a new story. Telling a different story, a narrative about how we got into this mess that we're in and the great things that are going on in the country at the local level, the whole sustainable communities and food, the whole food movement and other things. Those are the examples of bringing the future into the present in reality and seeing is believing. And when people see those things and see that it works and see that it's attractive, it can change minds.
That's the longtime environmental activist Gus Speth talking with Steve Paulson. Gus's books include America the Possible and the memoir Angels by the River.